Imagine for a second that you are holding a really high-end camera.
Okay.
You point it at this stunning landscape. You know, the mountains, the trees, the sky. The picture you get is beautiful, it's crisp, and it's incredibly useful. You can measure the height of the peaks, you can map out the trails with perfect precision.
Right, it does exactly what it's supposed to do.
Exactly. But then you turn that camera around, you try to take a picture of the lens itself. Or worse, you try to take a picture of the photographer holding the camera. What happens then?
Well, things get blurry very, very quickly. You start running into these massive technical limitations.
Right, and that blurry photo,
Yeah.
that is essentially the exact problem we are wrestling with today in this deep dive. We've got this stack of sources on 19th century empiricism.
Which I know to a lot of you listening, 19th century empiricism sounds like the driest possible topic we could have picked.
It really sounds like something you'd use to cure insomnia.
It definitely has that reputation.
But reading through this, it's almost like a ghost story. It's the story of what happens when thinkers decide to turn the quote-unquote lens of the scientific method onto the human mind itself.
Yeah, it's about that specific moment when we decided to stop asking why we're here and started asking how do we work.
And the answer turned out to be much more unsettling than anyone expected. It leads to what our source material calls the dissolution of the self.
Which is a heavy concept.
Very heavy. So we are looking at a roughly 200-year journey here, focusing on three absolute titans of this era: Auguste Comte, John Stuart Mill, and Ernst Mach.
But before we even get to them, we really have to set the scene. The source material opens with this fantastic little anecdote about the divide between British and European philosophy.
Yeah, the ship's passing in the night.
Exactly. It's a great visual. This actually comes from the 1940s, so a bit later than our main timeline, but it perfectly illustrates the legacy of what happened in the 19th century. There were these joint conferences held between English and French philosophers, and you have to picture the scene. The French philosophers are politely speaking English. And the English philosophers are politely speaking French.
So they're literally speaking each other's language. They are making the effort to connect.
Technically,
Yeah.
yes. But the historical records show it was a complete disaster. They were described as ships passing in the night. They weren't just disagreeing on the answers to philosophical questions, they couldn't even agree on what the questions were in the first place.
Why is that? What was so fundamentally different about how they saw the world?
Well, the continent, meaning Europe, thinkers in France and Germany was completely obsessed with the human spirit, with consciousness, with phenomenology. They were looking out from the human experience. They viewed reality through the lens of creative freedom.
While the British empiricists were doing what?
They were looking at the human experience like it was a bug under a microscope. They were doubling down on this concept of scientism.
Scientism, that is a very loaded word.
It is. It's essentially the belief that the scientific method isn't just for rocks and stars and chemicals. It is the absolute only way to know anything at all. Psychology, ethics, sociology, they wanted to turn all of it into rigorous, hard science.
And that is our mission for you today. We
Right.
want to dive into how they tried to do that and why, by trying to make everything scientific, they ended up arguing that we can never actually know reality at all.
It is a classic case of be careful what you wish for.
Let's start with the toolkit they were using. The sources emphasize that this wasn't just, the Enlightenment part two, the actual method changed.
Dramatically. In the old days, thinkers like Descartes or Spinoza, they started with what they called self-evident
The
truths.
rationalists.
Right. They started with premises they felt were undeniable, like I think, therefore I am, or God is perfect. You don't go into a lab and prove these things, you just know them. And then you build your logic on top of them, like you're doing a geometry proof.
But by the 19th century, thinkers like John Stuart Mill looked at that and basically said, that's lazy.
Lazy is a very polite way to put it. They realized that these so-called certainties were completely unverified. You can't just declare a truth because it feels right to your intuition. You have to test it. And this is the birth of the hypothetico-deductive method.
Which is a massive mouthful.
It is, but it's actually quite intuitive when you break it down. Think about how a detective works in a modern crime drama on TV. They don't just walk into a crime scene and magically know the truth instantly.
Yeah.
And they also don't just collect random pieces of trash, hoping it eventually makes
They
sense.
have a theory, like the butler did it.
Exactly. They form a hypothesis. The butler did it. Then they deduce. If the butler did it, then we should find his fingerprints on the candlestick. Then they actually go look for the fingerprints. That is the hypothetico-deductive method in a nutshell. You guess the rule, then you test the consequences.
That seems pretty obvious to us today, doesn't it? Isn't that just how science works?
It is now. But compare it to Francis Bacon back in the 1600s. Bacon thought science was strictly about gathering data. You go out, you collect 1,000 beetles, you look at them, and eventually a pattern just emerges on its own.
Like a brute force approach to knowledge.
Precisely, just overwhelming data collection. But 19th century thinkers realized the human mind just doesn't work like that. We need a framework, we need a hypothesis to even know what to look for. But here's the catch, and it's a huge one.
I knew there was a catch coming.
If you swap out your ironclad certainties for hypotheses, you are basically admitting that you never firmly know the absolute truth.
Wow.
You only know that your hypothesis hasn't been proven wrong yet.
So a certainty is a rock you can stand on. A hypothesis is just a bet you haven't lost yet.
And they wanted to place that bet on everything, including the human mind, ethics, society. But this whole shift leads to a massive philosophical consequence called phenomenalism, or more strictly speaking, anti-realism.
Anti-realism sounds like they don't believe the physical world exists.
Yeah.
Like we're all living in the matrix or a simulation.
It's a bit more subtle than that. It's not that the world doesn't exist out there. It's that we can't ever know it as it truly is.
Okay.
If all of our science is based on observation and testing, then we can only ever know our observations. We know the phenomena, the appearances of things. We cannot know the noumena, the actual thing in itself.
So just to make this concrete for the listener, I can know that my desk looks brown, it feels hard, and it makes a thud when I hit it. But I can't know what the desk actually is apart from my sensing of it.
That's the gist of it. They explicitly reject metaphysics. They completely stop asking, what is reality? Because to them, that's an impossible, unscientific question. They settle for, what are the data points?
Which feels like a huge compromise. We gave up the deep why to get a really, really accurate how.
And that is the fundamental trade-off of 19th century thought.
Okay, let's look at the man who sort of drew the blueprint for this entire movement. Auguste Comte?
Auguste Comte, a French thinker, died in 1857. He's a fascinating, somewhat eccentric character. He famously championed this idea of the unity of science.
He's the one with the law of three stages, right?
Yeah.
I actually really loved this part of the reading because he basically tries to psychoanalyze the entire human species. He says humanity grows up in the exact same way a single person does.
It's a really bold analogy. He says the human mind and society as a whole evolves through three distinct stages. We start in the religious stage. This is essentially the childhood of our species.
The monster under the bed phase.
In a way, yeah. It's where we use our imagination to fill in the massive gaps in our knowledge. We see lightning strike and we say, well, Zeus must be angry. We see a king on a throne and say, God put him there.
Right.
We explain the physical world through supernatural agents. It's a very comforting way to view the world.
Yeah.
But according to Comte, it's childish.
But then we grow up a bit and hit puberty. The speculative stage.
Right. The adolescence of the mind. And this is where Comte gets a bit spicy because he throws a lot of things we currently cherish right into this bucket. He says this is where we replace gods with abstract entities.
Give me an example of an abstract entity.
Natural rights or universals or even the idea of equality.
Wait, he thinks human rights are just an adolescent phase.
He really does. Think about it from his strict scientific perspective. If you say to Comte, all men are born equal, he would look at you and say, show me the data.
Which you can't do.
Exactly. You can't put equality in a test tube. It's an abstract concept. It's a metaphysical idea. To him, relying on that is just intellectual adolescence. It's a step up from blaming Zeus, but it's still not real in the empirical, measurable sense.
That is incredibly harsh. So what does actual adulthood look like to him then?
The positive stage. Or the scientific stage. This is maturity. We stop looking for hidden rites or magical essences or gods. We look exclusively for what is positively known.
Hence the term positivism.
Correct. We look for general covering laws that allow us to make accurate predictions about behavior and matter.
And for Comte, this wasn't just academic theorizing. He lived through the absolute chaos of post-revolutionary France. He saw heads literally roll. He didn't just want a philosophy. He wanted a science of social change. He wanted to predict riots the same way a meteorologist predicts a rainstorm.
Which is exactly why he, along with Saint-Simon, invented sociology.
He coined the term, right?
He literally invented the word. And he put sociology at the very top of his hierarchy of sciences. He thought all sciences were connected. You start with math, then physics, chemistry, biology, building up in complexity until you reach the most complex system of all, human society.
There's a detail here that really struck me in the notes. Comte actually takes a pretty massive swing at Descartes. Now, Descartes is usually the hero of logic. He's the I think, therefore I am guy. But Comte thought he completely wimped out.
He did. Descartes was a dualist. He viewed the human body as a machine, just hydraulics and levers and pulleys. But he kept the mind totally sacred. He said the soul was this ghost in the machine given by God and science couldn't touch it. Comte looked at that and said, no, you didn't go nearly far enough.
He wanted to evict the ghost entirely.
He wanted phrenology. He wanted physiology. He argued that the mind is just the physical brain and the brain is just biology.
Wow.
There is no soul to study. There is only organ function. He essentially wanted to make psychology a sub-branch of biology.
So Comte really sets the table here. He says, everything is science, even your private thoughts. But the man who really sat down and ate the meal was John Stuart Mill. The source actually calls him the most empirical of all empiricists.
Mill is the absolute heavyweight of this era. If Comte built the house, Mill designed the furniture and moved in. And to really understand how radical Mill was, you have to look at his concept of psychologism.
Which sounds like a disorder you'd find in a medical manual, but it's actually a theory of logic.
It is. And it's the idea that tends to break most people's brains the first time they hear it. Previous thinkers always thought that logic and mathematics were absolute, undeniable truths.
Right.
3 + 5 = 8 was seen as a cosmic necessity. It's true on Earth. It's true on Mars. It was true before the universe was even born.
I mean, 3 + 5 = 8 is a fact, isn't it?
Well, Mill says.
Wow.
How do you actually know that?
Because.
Yeah.
Well, because it just does. If I have 3 apples and I get 5 more apples, I have 8 apples.
Mill would say, exactly. You think that because every single time you've seen 3 things and put them next to 5 things, you counted 8 things.
So to him, math is just a habit.
He calls it an empirical generalization, a very, very strong one, obviously. But he argues that we only know it's true because we've observed it over and over. We just haven't seen a case where 3 + 5 = 9.
That is wild.
It gets crazier. He argues that the fundamental laws of logic, like the law that something can't be both true and false at the exact same time, are just generalizations about how the human physical brain happens to process information.
So if we met aliens who were wired differently biologically,
then perhaps for them, 3 + 5 implies something completely different. Mill refuses to admit there are any cosmic truths floating out there in the ether. There are only observations made by physical human minds.
That is terrifyingly slippery ground. If you take away the absolute truth of basic math, what is even left? It feels like the floor is just dropping out from under us.
That is the feeling of radical empiricism taking over, and Mill just keeps stripping things away. Look at how he defines matter. If we can't do metaphysics, if we can't talk about a table having substance, what is this table between us?
Right. He calls it the permanent possibility of sensation.
Which is such a dense, lawyer-like definition.
It sounds like a legal disclaimer on a bottle of medication. Warning. May contain permanent possibility of sensation.
It basically means the table isn't a thing in the deep metaphysical sense. It's just a guarantee. If you were to walk into this room tomorrow, you would see it. If you reached out your hand, you would touch it. As long as the possibility of sensation is there, we say the matter exists, but there is nothing underneath the sensation holding it all together.
Okay, I can sort of wrap my head around the table being just a reliable sensory trick, but then he applies this exact same logic to me, to the human mind.
This is where it gets very dark. He defines the mind as the permanent possibility of reflection.
I really don't like that.
It's the exact same logic. He says the mind isn't a soul. It isn't a deep self that sits inside your head driving the bus of your body. The mind is just a series of conscious states, thoughts, feelings, memories strung together like pearls.
But they are pearls without a string.
Exactly. David Hume famously called it a bundle of perceptions. Mill adds this permanent possibility idea to try and explain why I feel like the me of yesterday is the same as the me of today. He's desperately trying to account for memory and anticipation without admitting there's an actual soul doing the remembering.
But this creates a massive problem for ethics, doesn't it? Mill is incredibly famous for utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. But if there is no soul, if I am just a bundle of fleeting reflections, why does my happiness even matter? Who is there to be happy?
You've hit the nail right on the head. This is the crisis of the transcendental ego. That's just the fancy philosophical term for the deep self. If there is no deep permanent self inside you, then on what basis do you have human rights?
Well, someone like Kant would say, I have rights because I am a rational agent. I have inherent dignity.
But Mill has completely completely dismantled the agent. In Mill's view, you are essentially just a biological campaigner for pleasure and pain. So, justice isn't about respecting your inherent dignity. It's entirely about utility. We have rights only because giving people rights tends to produce a happier, smoother-running society, not because the rights are intrinsically real.
That feels incredibly fragile. If my rights only exist because they're useful to the group, what happens when they suddenly stop being useful?
We obviously saw that play out in some horrific ways in the 20th century, but look at how this applies to crime and punishment. This is a fascinating part of the reading. Usually, if someone commits a crime, society says, you are guilty. You chose to do bad. You need to pay for it.
Right, the retributivist view. You balance the scales of justice.
But Mill can't really do that. If your actions are completely determined by your character, and your character is just a bundle of biological associations and past experiences.
But I didn't really choose in the free will sense.
Right. Mill is what we call a compatibilist. He thinks our choices are determined by our internal programming, our desires and motives. So punishment isn't about cosmic justice. It's about programming. You punish to deter others. You punish to reform the criminal's future behavior.
This is what the source calls the therapeutic theory of punishment.
Yes. And on the surface, that sounds very progressive, right? Don't punish him. Heal him. He's not evil. He's just sick.
But the source brings in C.S. Lewis to drop the hammer on this idea. And just to be clear to you listening, we're not taking sides here, but Lewis's critique of this is really profound to think about.
Lewis actually despised this idea. He argued that the humanitarian theory is secretly the most dehumanizing thing you can possibly do to a person.
How so? Trying to cure someone seems nice.
Because if you punish me, you are treating me like a free agent who made a choice. You are respecting my dignity as a human who is ultimately responsible for their actions. I pay my debt to society and I walk away free. But if you cure me, you are treating me like a broken toaster.
Wow.
You are treating me like a socially maladjusted object that needs to be tinkered with by the state until I finally think the right thoughts.
It strips away moral agency completely. It literally turns a citizen into a patient.
Exactly. And once you are a patient, it's the state that decides when you are finally cured. It's a pretty chilling thought when you really follow the logic of empiricism all the way down to its roots.
And speaking of following it all the way down, we have one final figure who looked at Mill and essentially said, you are still believing in too much. Ernst Mach.
Mach. The Austrian physicist. Died in 1916. He really takes this ball and runs it all the way into the end zone.
Mach looked at Mill's permanent possibility of sensation and said, why do you even need the permanent possibility part? Just stick with the sensation.
Mach proposes sensationalism. He says the world consists only of sensations. Red, hard, loud, hot. That is the absolute only reality we have any access to.
And everything else. The atoms, the forces, gravity.
Everything else is a tool. This is instrumentalism. Mach argued that science isn't about finding the truth or drawing a map of reality. It's simply about economy. It's about organizing our sensory data as efficiently as possible so we don't get overwhelmed.
So wait. An atom? Is it real?
To Mach, an atom is a useful fiction. It's a mathematical shortcut. He called them ideal objects. We construct them in our minds to make sense of the mess of data hitting our eyes and ears. But he warned us not to mistake our models for actual reality.
That is just wild to think about.
Yeah.
He's a pioneering physicist who basically says physics is just a really elaborate filing system.
In a way, yes. We moved all the way from the Enlightenment, where we sought absolute certainty about the nature of God and the universe, to a point where we admit we don't know what reality is. We only know our data, and our theories are just tools to manage that data.
It's a total retreat from the deep why to the useful how.
And that really brings us right back to that initial image of the camera you brought up at the start.
Right, the lens.
These thinkers, Comte, Mill, Mach, they desperately wanted to explain everything through rigorous science. They wanted to pin down the world. But by reducing the human mind to a bundle of perceptions and reducing science to just a tool for organizing data, they kind of painted themselves into a corner.
The source calls it the dissolution of the self.
It is. Think about it. If the self is just, as Mill said, a permanent possibility of reflection, it begs this really haunting question, who is the one doing the reflecting?
If I am just a bundle of sensations, who's feeling them?
That is the ghost they couldn't quite exercise. They built this magnificent, incredibly useful machine to explain the universe, but in the process, they realized there was absolutely no one left in the driver's seat.
And on that slightly terrifying note, we are going to wrap up. It really makes you wonder, when we look at the world strictly through the lens of science, are we seeing everything, or are we actively filtering out the most important part ourselves?
That is exactly the kind of question that keeps philosophers awake at night.
Something for you to mull over today. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We will see you next time.